Both countries are part of the physical world, all spheres are part of the astral world, but they work separately and for very definite reasons. The most material part of the astral world, the densest part, is the sphere, which surrounds you immediately after death, and whilst you live in this dense part of the astral world, you see all the things around you that you saw when you were living in the physical world. Say you lived in London during your lifetime, it is more than probable that after death you would remain in the astral counterpart or reflection of London, merely because, to begin with, you want to remain in touch with something which you understand. You want to see people around you, and to have a perfect home where you can entertain friends as before. Then one day, perhaps a friend points out to you that life in town has few advantages in the astral world, and suggests that you see the beauties of the countryside. You can easily visualize the difference in atmosphere between an existence amongst the teeming millions, which comprise a metropolis, and the comparative peace of a country village, where the inhabitants are counted in dozens instead of thousands or millions. This is the second sphere which, for want of a better description, I have suggested should be thought of as being one title above the level of the first sphere, and where you would find many families happily carrying on their existence, with social intercourse and the usual things which go with the idea of the perfect country life. You can live in these spheres as long as you like. A very coarse and material type of person is happiest in the densest part of the astral world, for that part is nearest to and most like the physical world to which he is so attached, and here he continues to live a very limited existence. These are not spheres in which a developed person, a man who has some spiritual background, would be particularly happy, were he forced to remain under these conditions for long. He is not so forced, and after passing through the purgatory period, in which he is shown the results of the good and evil actions of this past life, the realization of which influences his future character, he begins to feel an urge to get away from anything which is similar to the life that is over, and the revelation comes to him of the immense possibilities for interesting and profitable experiences, which await him in the higher and less dense spheres of the astral world. Eventually he settles down to live his astral life surrounded by conditions which are in keeping with his actual development. This may be on the third sphere, where he meets the type of individual who is a creator, musicians, artists, scientists, etc., or on the fourth sphere, where he can discuss world problems with men who have greater intellects than himself. When an astral entity of human origin reaches these spheres, he becomes aware that they are also inhabited by other entities, which he finds are of non-human origin. It is important that you know something about these entities and their origin before you have further astral experiences, so I shall tell you something about them now. These entities comprise a parallel evolution called the Deva or Angel Kingdom. They evolve in a similar way to the human kingdom, in that instead of individualizing from the animal kingdom into the human, these entities, which previously were seen and known as insects, fish or birds, individualize into elementals, nature spirits and devas or angels. When the time comes for a bird or fish to progress to the next stage of its development, it becomes either an elemental or a nature spirit, according to its type in the physical world. You will remember when I took you under the sea on your first astral journey, I showed you some of the elementals that live at the bottom of the ocean. Originally these were fish, and in their natural journey towards their goal of perfection, they have to change from fish to elementals in just the same way that dogs, cats, horses etc. change from their animal types into the unevolved types of humans that we know of in the world. Birds, for example, turn into nature spirits, fairies they are sometimes called, and both these elementals and nature spirits, after many progressive lives, reach a stage where they become what the world describes as devas or angels. Now there is a great difference between the two evolutions, in that the deva evolution does not inhabit the physical world after the fish or bird has progressed to the elemental or nature spirit stage. It only inhabits the astral and mental worlds, and apart from the lower elementals and very junior or unevolved types of nature spirits, They do not live below the third sphere of that astral world. That is why so little is known of this evolution by people living in the physical world. They hardly contact it, as far as the ordinary individual is concerned, though human beings who have developed the dormant sense of clairvoyance can of course see these creatures even at the physical level, for there is no closed door to the clairvoyant between the astral and the physical worlds of consciousness. But as I have said, the average man has no such knowledge, and usually he ridicules the stories that are circulated concerning the existence of such entities. It is only in undeveloped countries, where the inhabitants are nearer to nature than the average, that the little people as fairies and nature spirits are called in Ireland, are recognized. There, although the majority of people have never seen them, the leprechauns, gnomes and elves are acknowledged to exist. To this day many farmers refuse to till a particular piece of land, which folklore maintains is used by the fairies. Many are the stories that are told, where materialistic modern owners of the land, scoffing at the old stories as rubbish and superstition, have suffered misfortune which the local inhabitants put down to their having insulted the little people. I do not propose to comment on whether these bad luck stories are founded on fact or not, for frankly, it would be impossible to give any general opinion on the subject. Each case would have to be separately investigated, in order to ascertain the truth, and it does not happen to be my present task to make such investigations. I tell you, however, that on the astral plane these entities not only exist, but they play an important part in the life of the astral world. And after death, when you reach the third and higher spheres, you will not only see them for yourself, but will have contact with them as I shall describe n. For this reason, a man passes to the fourth sphere, he would at first be impressed by the entire absence of what might be described as activity. He would meet people there, of course, and, if he had not already met them in his past physical life, be introduced to them in exactly the same way as people are introduced in the physical world. He would be welcomed as a man of similar interests to themselves by the permanent inhabitants of that sphere, who know that he could not have progressed as far as the fourth sphere, unless he had the necessary desire and qualifications to enable him to function there. Instead of physical activity, he would find much mental activity, for the main interest of the inhabitants there is discussing international and evolutionary problems. Discussions relating to the development of science, discussions relating to the parallel evolution of the Deva Kingdom with its great differences from our evolution and so on, or the formulating of theories, which they endeavor to test out. All this may sound very dull to you, but to an intellectual type of individual, it is not dull at all. Of course the people one meets vary intellectually, and those who have the finest intellects, who are actually the older and more experienced souls, take the lead in the discussions, as is natural for them to do. In many cases, members of the Deva Kingdom join the deliberations/discussions, though intercommunication in such instances is not made through the medium of words, for although not yet living in the mental world, where everything is governed by thoughts, it is found that in the higher levels of the astral world conversations can be carried on without the actual use of words. Life is so much less material there that the possibilities of exchange of thoughts comes quite naturally, and there is no question of such things being considered either marvelous or extraordinary. You must remember that the Devas who inhabit the fourth sphere of the astral world are also evolved beings, as different from the low type elementals and nature spirits as evolved men are different from the low types of ghoulies met within the physical world. The mental outlook of a Deva is quite different from the mental outlook of a human. The Deva is mostly interested in the processes of nature. Their lives are so mixed up with natural features, oceans, mountains, trees, flowers, rainfall and the like, that they do not seem to be the slightest bit affected by the problems of life, which interest mankind except in special cases where their assistance is desired. Although the growth or decline of nations does not touch them, the progress of plant life, the scientific research work whereby nature provides man with his physical needs, interests them greatly. There is an evolved deva in charge of each different type of tree, shrub or flower. Under these controllers work thousands of assistants, all of whom seem to have their special duties. Where too many trees are cut down by the inroads of so-called civilization, the devolution endeavors to produce new trees to take the place of those destroyed. The experiments of modern science, in such efforts as producing rain by artificial means, are matters of great interest to the Deva Kingdom, and in their own way they endeavor to influence man in his research activities, along the right lines. Apostrophe The Deva Kingdom expresses itself through color, and anyone who is interested in landscape gardening will see marvelous results achieved by the Devas in their activities on the third and fourth spheres of the astral world. In exactly the same way that a scientific gardener in the physical world endeavors to produce flowers of different colors by judicious grafting and pollination, the Deva experiments also and, as his knowledge is so much greater in that he is nearer to nature than his human counterpart, produces much more beautiful results. It is quite impossible to describe in words the beauty of the flowers produced by the Deva Kingdom, for there are many hundreds of colors where we only have dozens, and we have no names for these minute variations of what we call reds, blues and purples. Apostrophe The Devas also seem to express themselves in sound, with a view to influencing the activities of life. We often talk about producing the right atmosphere, and what we mean by that, usually, is getting people into a harmonious frame of mind. The Devas express themselves as an evolution in a much bigger way, and that which is called Deva music is the result. Large numbers of Devas gather together in woods and dells, using weird wood instruments to produce the most beautiful sounds, always in perfect harmony. Their voices seem to be pitched much higher than human voices, but are much softer. They do not use words as we understand words. They sing mostly in huge choirs, but there are also soloists who from time to time sing by themselves, the main choir remaining silent, whilst the passage is being rendered. The soloists usually perch themselves on high trees some distance from the main choir, and the result is absolutely amazing to our ears. It is quite impossible to give an adequate description of these concerts to anyone who has not heard them, but undoubtedly they produce an atmosphere which the Devas say affects the whole human race. It is probably their way of expressing peace and goodwill to all men, for they certainly could never understand the differences of opinion in the world that can lead to such things as modern wars. Apostrophe The Deva has no possessions, as we understand possessions, nor does he need any. From his early days as a nature spirit, he does not have to earn money in order to support himself, and so, perhaps, he can be considered more fortunate than his human counterpart. Although these Devas do not seem to laugh or enjoy themselves in ways that we understand, they are only too willing to be friendly and helpful to men when called upon. In some ways they do not seem to be interested in human affairs at all, yet in special cases, where earthquakes or volcanic eruptions have taken place, they seem to have their special work to do, for anything to do with nature, land, sea, flora or fauna, is their world. An earthquake or volcanic eruption is a natural phenomenon affecting part of the Earth's surface. When these tragedies take place, large numbers of Devas are sent to help where they can. What exactly they do, I cannot tell you. But they certainly have their part to play in the scheme of things, and one day I expect we shall know more about their work than we do today. They also play their part in helping with human emotions. As I have said, bodily illness is quite unknown under astral conditions, but emotional upsets, where people become extremely depressed, occur, for the astral world is the world of emotion and the astral body is our vehicle of emotional consciousness. In such cases, the Devas seem to nurse depressed people back to emotional health. They soothe the people and bring them into touch with their divine music, the effect of which on one who is not very happy is very marked indeed. It is not often that one sees a really unhappy individual in the astral world, for the conditions there make it difficult to be unhappy, but there are cases where people are troubled, and the Deva people then act as doctors and nurses in a very effective way. I have given you sufficient to think of, Expect me at 11 o'clock on the following day, when I hope you will have a full account of your experiences ready for me. I leave you now. What a morning. The weather was exceedingly warm and humid, and my Indian friend had talked for longer than he usually does, though what he said has been even more interesting than it has been on the days that have gone before. He is opening up a new vision of life in the world that follows this, which, if true, certainly makes the contacting of that world even more interesting than it was before. Not only am I excited at the prospect of another astral journey, but if this trip turns out to be equally thrilling to the one I had last week, then it will be wonderful indeed. I do not remember having seen Charles since that memorable night, and somehow I have not been in any way worried about this, for now I know that he is all right. The absence of his physical presence worries me no more. I am no longer sad. I feel that at any time I can contact him if the need is great, and also there is the feeling which amounts to a certainty, that he is not gone from us, that he is still very much in the land of the living. What this means to me is difficult to describe in mere words, but I am already beginning to want to talk to other people who are sad for the same reason that I was sad, to comfort them and explain something of this scheme which seems to rule the universe. Perhaps that is one of the reasons why I have been helped, for the urge to pass on this information to others, and have the capacity for giving them proof such as my Indian friend is able to give me, is very strong within me. Possibly one day I shall be able to put my urge into effect. The next evening I went to the cinema, and as it was a thriller, it held my interest for a couple of hours. I went to bed immediately. I returned and tried the trick of imagining a mirror over my bed just before I settled myself for sleep. This time I did get a little result, for at the moment of losing consciousness, I remember finding myself standing in my bedroom, and there, sure enough, was my body lying peacefully on the bed. I remember distinctly, starting to open my bedroom door, even as I put my hand on the knob, I found that I was, as it were, half through the door, and immediately I remembered that doors are no obstacle to the astral body, so I wandered forth. I glided down the stairs a foot or so above the steps, and I recollect this because I lowered my head so as to miss the overhang at the point where the stairs turned the corner. Of course, bowing my head was quite unnecessary, but it was instinctive on my part. I went through the front door and floated gently towards the harbour and sea. The next thing I remember was waking up this morning at the usual hour. I lay quite still, delving deeply into my inner consciousness, but nothing more than the few details that started off my night's rambling could I recall. Never mind, even that is something, and I am rather thrilled to find that without help I was able to retain continuity of consciousness at the moment of going to sleep, and even remember the first stage of my astral journeyings. It is 9:30 p.m., I have finished my light dinner. I am now going to take the tablet and get into bed. What will I experience this time? Chapter 7. This time I do not seem to have been asleep at all. When I realized this morning that I was again in my body, the remembrance of everything that had taken place was clear in my brain, just as if I had been to a theater and had been asked to write down all the details of the play. Thus, I was able to settle down with my pad and pencil and record faithfully everything that had happened. After taking the tablet, I looked at my little French clock whose hands stood at 9:42 p.m. I did not try to go to sleep, but within a few minutes I found that I had slipped out of my body and was standing at the side of the bed with my sleeping form lying there upon it. Again I looked, and it was 9:55. There was no one about, and I walked round my room marveling at the simplicity of what, on the occasion of my first astral journey, had struck me as extremely complicated. I did not attempt to leave my room, for I remembered quite clearly that my Indian friend had said he would be here at 10 o'clock, so I awaited his coming, quite sure that he would not let me down. Next time I looked at my clock, it was 10 o'clock, still nothing happened. 5 minutes passed, and I wondered whether the whole thing was going to turn out a flop. I became more and more worried as the minutes ticked away, but refused to be tempted to experiment on my own, and just as I was about to look at my clock again, I heard the now familiar voice behind me saying, "Did you think I was going to disappoint you?" My friend stated that he was late because he had been helping a particular friend of his who had died that morning. He said this man had dreaded dying and, although he had been ill for many months, he had fought death right up to the end. He explained that this was quite useless, as his time had come, and although he had probably kept life in his body for a few weeks by his extreme willpower, in the end death had prevailed. The illness this man had suffered from, for months, had at last so weakened his physical body that it was impossible for the etheric matter to remain within it. He stated that he had been helping this man to get rid of his etheric vehicle, which he tried to keep with him, this being now the nearest thing to the physical life, the only life he understood. Getting the man to make the necessary effort of will to disconnect the etheric from the astral body, round which it had wound itself, had taken longer than usual. "He's all right now," he said, "and I have left him with some astral helpers, who will probably I wish to remain, until through practical experience he learns something about the law." I asked him what were we going to do this time. He replied that it was desirable that I should first get experience of passing from the lower to the higher spheres. He took a lot of trouble in explaining to me that although he called them higher spheres, they were not actually above each other but rather all around us, being conditions of different density only. Over London WW2, he suggested we should start our expedition from London. So we set off as we had done the last time, and in no time slowed down over what was obviously land. Almost at once I recognized the huge city below us as London. The objects we passed on our way were in no way clear. I could just distinguish between land and sea. It was as if we were looking at a moving picture of scenery, which was being projected onto a screen at a very quick rate. There was no effort whatsoever in moving, and although it took us what seemed to be less than a minute, we did not arrive breathless in any way. We dropped down as before in Hyde Park. I was told that this was the best place to land as, although we were going to Piccadilly Circus, to land there could easily cause me to get frightened owing to the terrific traffic and the possibility of my feeling, quite erroneously, that I might get run over. If I were to get frightened in this way, my fear would be transmitted to my physical body on the bed in Colombo, which would immediately endeavor to attract its owner back to it. The fear having caused me in my astral body to return hurriedly to my natural form of consciousness, I should consequently awake with my heart thumping, probably remembering what I would describe as a beastly nightmare, one which need not resemble the actual facts at all. It might be that I had been run over, and the fright caused by such an imaginary happening could result in unruly beating of my heart, as fear generally reacts thus on the physical body. As we came to Earth, I saw the familiar setting I had so often seen in days gone by. It was a sunny evening and there were many people out walking. Children with their mothers or nurses were playing about as usual, and not far off I could see the constant stream of traffic. Cars, taxis and buses that passed down Park Lane towards Piccadilly and Hyde Park Corner. I suggested walking down Oxford Street, and although the pavements were crowded with late shoppers on their way home, and shop assistants just released from their day's work, we were in no way hindered. As before, I felt the strange gossamer contact, perceptible every time I was forced to pass through a physical body, and it was quite difficult not to apologize. My friend, who did not like crowds, floated about 2 yards above the heads of passers-by. I soon did the same and we came to Earth again in Piccadilly Circus. Perhaps you would like to look at the scene of our last trip to London and see if you recognize any of the people in the foyer of the Trocadero? He said. I agreed, and we strolled in. The lounge was just filling up with people waiting for friends, with waiters flitting hither and thither, taking and executing orders. I saw no one there whom I knew and no sign of either Charles or Roy Chapman. I wondered if the latter had become bored with the perpetual round of meals and drinks that did not have to be paid for, but I did not ask. My friend beckoned to me and I understood that he wished to go upstairs. I followed without question and soon we were in a corridor which had several doors leading off it. He entered one of these rooms, which turned out to be a bedroom, untenanted. We had of course gone through the door, so needed no key. "Now," he said, "we had better be on our way. I came to this room so that we could be quiet, for I want you to realize that passing from the lowest sphere to the one less dense than this is quite a simple matter, only requiring an effort of will for it to become immediately effective. I want you to hold my hand and just wish to do what I do. You will not feel anything, but will notice that the scene around you changes gradually. The walls that seem to enclose us in this room will appear to melt, the furniture with which you are surrounded will slowly become vague and misty, and all the time you must let go, so that my will may dominate yours. Whatever happens, do not be nervous, for, if you panic at all, you will very soon wake up in Columbo. Now are you ready?" I replied that I was, and I experienced no fear at all, only interest. I held the hand of my friend firmly and tried my utmost to allow myself to be controlled by his will, and almost immediately the walls of the room became blurred and indistinct. The same applied to the furniture, and, in less time than it takes me to record, we were standing in the open air, in a small. Dogs of different kinds frisked about the lawns, and the voices of children could be heard as we passed by. One difference between these and similar houses in the world was the absence of garages, and I noticed that there were no cars on the streets. It was explained to me that there is no need for transport, for people can get from place to place by much easier methods, as they only have to express in thought the desire to go anywhere, and immediately they float gently from where they are to the destination to which they wish to go. I asked why there were shops when money was not needed. I was told that the people who find their happiness at this level like to live a life as near as possible to that they had always imagined as ideal when alive. "Some spend money," my guide said, "they create it by their own imagination, and they buy food which they prepare and even eat all in imagination, because that is what they wish." "But surely," I asked, "it is quite unnecessary to have shops when a thought would be sufficient to produce in one's home what one wanted?" "These shops," he replied, "have their origin in the minds of the inhabitants, and none of them exists in the world, nor do the people who serve in them. Once the residents here think a thing, it becomes a fact in this world of illusion. These shops are all figments of the imagination, together with the things that are sold therein, but so long as the people want to have shops near to them, they have them, for they imagine them." He continued, "It is the same with churches. People like to continue their religious practices, even though after death they may have found that many of the statements made by their priests and pastors had not been entirely correct. The permanent inhabitants build these churches, and ex-priests and ex-ministers of religion carry on their old vocations, drawing round them followers, just as they did in the life that has ended. Cinemas too are very popular, but whilst there is unending variety on the first sphere, it isn't quite the same on the second sphere. Here, cinemas are not the astral counterparts of such places in the world, but are the creations, in thought, of the permanent inhabitants. There are always ex-producers of films, or amateur producers, who create new films in their imagination, and their thought forms are produced on the screen for all to see. These shows are in many ways better than those we see in the world and those which astral inhabitants see on the first sphere, for, under astral conditions, producers can allow their imagination to run riot. There is no need to consider the cost of production here. Theatres are also popular at this level. Those who are interested in amateur theatricals as well as sex actors and actresses produce one play after another for the benefit of their friends and acquaintances, and they are able to do so quite easily, as there is no difficulty in obtaining the correct costumes, scenery or an orchestra, as these things are just created in their imagination and cost nothing. Some people still wish to live in hotels. Probably they are people who have always thought it would be wonderful to live in one of the big hotels that were far too expensive for them in the world. Now they can live in such hotels. That is why this hotel looks so very large compared with the size of the village. Such a hotel could not exist in an ordinary village in the world, but here it does not need to make a profit. People live in the hotel and have all the service and attention they want merely by imagining it, so they are happy, for a time.